Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And we're on the air. This is the Interpreter Radio Show, and I'm Martin Tanner in studio. With me also is Dan Peterson, who, it's great to have you here, Dan. You're not here very often, but it's wonderful when you are.
It's good to be here, and it's good to be out of the house.
We also have a wonderful guest with us by phone. For those of you who may not be familiar with him, I'm excited to introduce him. But before we do that, I wanted to talk a little bit about Interpreter Radio. You may be listening for the first time. Interpreter Radio is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which you can find at MormonInterpreter.com. And it is an organization, a 501c3, that defends the faith and that is involved in publishing scholarly articles in this radio show and podcasts and a number of other endeavors. It has Come Follow Me discussions on a weekly basis for those who are interested in learning some details about that. And it was started by Professor Dan Peterson, who's here in studio. Tell our listeners, Dan, just a little bit more about the Interpreter Foundation and perhaps its goals and what it does.
It's an all-volunteer operation. We started in August of 2012, and amazingly, we've kept going through generous donations of time and effort and money, yes. And our flagship thing is a journal that we publish now called the Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, and it's an online journal. It's free, accessible for free online in a number of formats. And the amazing thing is we've now published, I think we were founded about 402 and a half weeks ago, and we've now published at least one article, sometimes two, occasionally three, every week for 401 or 400, anyway, something like that, 401 weeks in a row. And then we also put on conferences, published a number of books, do the radio show, have a blog, just a lot of things going on.
One other thing that I wanted to mention before we get to our fabulous guest for this evening is that from a financial side, the Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady, Latter-day Saint Adventures, which is a wonderful travel company and will allow you to tour in various places in the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. And I'm kind of excited to mention this particular tour because we're going to invite you to join the Interpreter Foundation in an ultimate Egypt tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson. This will be on November 20th of 2020 this year. If you are on that tour, you'll see the best of Egypt, from the pyramids at Giza to the temples of Luxor and Karnak to the Valley of Kings and to the magnificent Temple of Ramses II. Space is limited. Call Cruise Lady at 801-453-8444. That's 901-453-9444, or find more information at cruiselady.com, 801-453-9444, or cruiselady.com. We thank them for their ongoing support. Wonderful organization. So now to our subject at hand. Our guest on the phone joining us from North Carolina is Melvin Morse, MD, who is a pioneer in near-death studies. He has published a number of books. He was the first one to report near-death experiences in children. Among his books are Closer to the Light, published by Random House, Parting Visions, Transformed by the Light, near-death experiences in a pediatric population, and a number of others. Melvin Morse, it's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Martin. It's really a privilege to be with you again. I've known you now for, 20, 30 years or so, and it's always a joy to be on the radio or meet you in person.
Well, that's very kind of you. I was thinking back. I think the first radio show that we did together was with little Crystal Merzlach when she was still a kid, and I think that was in 1989. So it has been, I think, 31 years or very close to that.
Yeah.
So tell our listeners how it is that you came to be involved in the study of near-death experiences, and that would probably entail Crystal Merzlach's case, and then maybe we can talk about a few others and then wrap up our discussion today with its application to the situation we find ourselves in here in the United States and the world with coronavirus, and why maybe people should be concerned but not excessively worried. Maybe I can say it that way.
Well, Martin, I think there's a lot of comfort from understanding the near-death experience, because the near-death experience is, in fact, the dying experience. But that's getting ahead of the story. I want the listeners to understand that I was a young resident. I wasn't even out of my medical training. I trained at Johns Hopkins. I really didn't have any religious beliefs. I'd never heard of a near-death experience. Frankly, what I had heard of them, I thought was just, just sort of, wishful thinking on the part of people who were describing, seeing heaven when they died, etc. And all that changed for me when I resuscitated Crystal Merzlach in Pocatello, Idaho. And she comes from a deeply Mormon family. And she went on really to inspire me to do the first study of near-death experiences in children based on her case. And just in a nutshell, she was as close to dead as you can be without actually dying. She nearly drowned in a community swimming pool. She was underwater for 22 minutes. And she was so far gone that I invited her family in to have a prayer circle around her. And, I felt that she could not survive. Well, she was transferred down to Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City, and sure enough, she did survive. And I saw her in follow-up when she came back, after she was discharged from the hospital. And I said, well, boy, Crystal, yeah, I'm sure you don't remember me, I sure remember you, I never thought that I would, be actually talking to you. You were so sick. And she looked at her mother and she says, remember, she was only 7 years old. She says, oh, I've seen him before. I saw him put a tube in my nose. and then she proceeded to describe her entire resuscitation, everything we did, chance comments that I made to the nursing staff, when I called my attending physicians for advice back at the Seattle Children's Hospital on how to handle the case. She said to me, I saw you put me in a big machine that looked like a donut, which was, of course, her description of a CAT scanner. And my jaw was just dropping, Martin. And I sort of laughed, sort of nervously, this can't be real. And then, Martin, she reached over and patted me on the wrist, and she said, "You'll see, Dr. Morse. Heaven is fun." And I knew right then that this was something really that this was real. There simply was no way that she could have described all of these things. This wasn't something that she had invented or some sort of fantasy or, you know, watching resuscitations on television or, you know, born out of her religious convictions or anything like that. This was a true experience that she had. She described what it was like to be in heaven. And she met people while she was in heaven. And she felt she had a choice to even return to this life, and she did it because of love for her mother. And it inspired me to see, at that time there had not been these kinds of experiences reported in children. So I returned to Seattle Children's Hospital. I was determined to see if this was just an oddity, or was it something that was quite common. And I found, to my surprise, we found 24 such cases at Seattle Children's Hospital.
Let me jump in here for just a second and add a couple of details that might be of special interest to our Latter-day Saint listeners in the Salt Lake City area. When Crystal went to heaven, she described meeting the Heavenly Father and sitting on Jesus' lap, as I recall. And she also described seeing things. Well, of course, you've described what was going on in her resuscitation in the hospital, but she also described things that were going on in her home with her family, her mother, father, and little brother. And this is the case that turned me from a skeptic into a believer, because I thought, how can you get a conspiracy with a doctor, nursing staff, kids, parents, and center it all around a little kid who probably couldn't keep a story straight if they were making it up for 10 minutes. And there was no explanation other than this was real.
Yes. And I think that there is, she continues to be, of course, in the Latter-day Saint. I think that is a part of a divine plan, if you will. I mean, I've gone from a complete skeptic who had no religious beliefs whatsoever into having a complete faith that we will meet this God, we will go to this heaven when we die. And that's, that, to me, is a scientific statement, Martin, based on our subsequent research at Seattle Children's Hospital. We studied all survivors of cardiac arrest, and we discovered, to our great surprise, that almost all of them had similar experiences, of course, based on their own religious beliefs, their own family background. But one of the most astonishing ones was a young boy who was in his family car, was coming home from a ski vacation in the mountains, and they skidded out of control and slipped over a railing and plunged into a lake that was below, and he was underwater for about 40 minutes until he was revived. And he says to me, I went to heaven in a huge noodle. I was suddenly traveling down a huge noodle. And then he looks at me and he said, no, it couldn't have been a noodle. It must have been a tunnel, because noodles don't have rainbows in them. and you know, that type of detail, you know, and I feel so privileged, really, to have heard these experiences. Because after that, you know, then he always described it as the tunnel. But hearing that first time where he's trying himself to understand what happened to him, you know, absolutely, to me, is the proof that these experiences are real. And he said something to me that really inspired my further research. Is he was struggling himself to understand it. And he looked at me and he said, after he described his experience, he said, but was it real, Dr. Morse? Because if it was real, then you've got to tell all the old people. And so we took him at his word seriously. Our study was done with the head of the Department of Neurology at Seattle Children's Hospital. It was done with Don Tyler, who was then head of the intensive care unit. So we had the best physicians on board. And we published our findings in the medical journals. And to make a long story short, these experiences are, in fact, real. We will all have this experience when we die. And the implications of what we learn from this experience is precisely what we are talking about with what's going on in our country right now. Because we learn from these experiences not just that we meet God when we die, but the children all say one consistent thing, that we're here in this life to learn lessons of love. And, you know, that was from Crystal Birchlock. In fact, her life is one lifelong lesson of love, in which is inspiring to see how she's lived her life. But she felt this love for her mother that caused her to return to this earth, and that we're here to learn lessons. That you know, this is not our home, and I think that applies to our current situation.
It certainly does. You mentioned that you've gone from skeptic to believer, and then when we were talking earlier today, you mentioned that you believe this is now scientific fact. That's a pretty bold statement. Where would you go, or to what would you point to make a claim like that?
It's a scientific fact that this experience will happen to us all when we die. I don't think that science can then go any further. You know, I don't think that we can comment on, you know, I mean, we ultimately all have to have faith. If somebody wants to believe, Martin, that these experiences are just some sort of dramatic last-minute gasps of brain activity when we die, and that somehow you are given extrasensory powers to see what's going on around you, but that doesn't mean anything else. And if somebody wants to believe that, and if they want to believe that this loving light that embraces you and tries to help you to understand your life and teaches you lessons, if they want to believe that that's all hallucination, then I don't think that science can comment further. That is an issue of faith. But nevertheless, having said that, it's not just my own research, but every researcher who has looked into this issue of what is the near-death experience has concluded that these experiences are not the cause of oxygen deprivation to the brain. They're not caused by the many drugs that we give patients when we resuscitate them. They're not some sort of fear reaction because you're, a child's in the scary intensive care unit. Maybe they have some sort of need to believe that they were in heaven, something like that. We studied and we controlled for all those factors. And it's not just my research. There's been research from the Netherlands. There's been research done by the University of Virginia by Bruce Grayson, published in all of the major medical journals. There simply is no one who has looked at this issue from a scientific standpoint who hasn't come to the same conclusion that these experiences are real.
This is fascinating stuff. This is Dan Peterson here. Do you think that that the experiences of children have something unique, carry some sort of unique dimension to them as opposed to experiences reported by adults?
Absolutely. The children's experience is so pure and so filled with wonder. And frankly, they usually just say, "I saw a light. And it had a lot of good things for me in it," or they'll say, one girl had her severe liver failure from infectious mononucleosis. We had to put a needle into her heart to resuscitate her. So that's true clinical death that she was brought back from, and she was surrounded by a white light. And her grandmother was there, who had passed, to help her with the experience. And she says to me, she described her grandmother, and she says, "And then I was back." And I said, "Well, what do you mean by that, you were back?" And she she clenched her fist and she said, "That's what I've been trying to figure out." So they're very pure and simple. They describe they usually just say, "I met God, I met Jesus, I met the Heavenly Father." It's not the sort of thing that you could write a book about. The adult experiences just go on and on and on, and that's because they're bringing their own religious beliefs and their own personal convictions, and grafting that all into the experience. So you see the pure near-death experience when you interview these children, and usually it's just as simple as, well, one boy, we resuscitated him, and he looks up at me, and he goes, "That was weird. You guys just sucked me back into my body." And then he looks around, and he goes, "Where's Jesus? You guys took my Jesus from me." because in his experience, he had felt that he was lifted up by Jesus. And, of course, when he came back to his body, that disappeared. And that was his entire experience. So, it's so pure and simple. And frankly, if I heard just adult experiences with all the embellishments and a lot of times they seem to have their own agendas, I'm not sure I would believe them. But when you hear them from children, you know that we are all going to meet this loving light, this God, when we die, and we're all going to be told the same thing, that we were here to learn lessons of love.
One of the stories,
and that's what we're all struggling with now.
Yeah. One of the stories that you mentioned to me years ago that I thought was illustrative of what we're talking about now, that children see these as a pure experience and they don't necessarily relate them to formal religion or something other than, they may mention Jesus or Heavenly Father or something. I remember you asking a child, "So did you die?" "Oh, no, Dr. Morse, that's when they put you in a box and bury you in the ground. I went to a really fun place," or something to that effect.
Yeah, right. Well, there's no doubt. One of the things, particularly now that we're so isolated, and I think that we do fear dying alone, and that is clearly not the case. None of us die alone. We're all, as you would fear, and you learn this from children, that so often different comfort objects from them. One boy told me that when he was in the tunnel, he was greeted by a dog that had been his favorite dog who had previously passed. One of the most interesting ones was a young girl who accidentally electrocuted herself before they had these, those special GFI switches in the bathrooms. She was listening to her stereo and knocked it into the bathtub and was electrocuted. And when we resuscitated her afterwards, she said to me, "You know what was really nice? Was that nurse who held my hand during the whole time that you guys were putting those tubes in me and doing all those things to me." And she said, "It was so great. She was all dressed in white, and she made me feel so safe and so loved. Thank her for me." This was a teenager. And, of course, she was describing, an angel that we don't actually have. In the hub of resuscitation, we don't have a nurse who's just dedicated to holding their hands. But this was an angel who accompanied her with her dying experience. And Crystal Merzlach, the first, the girl we were talking about, she said that after she witnessed our resuscitation efforts, she was in a tunnel and she started to crawl. And then finally, a woman came to her named Elizabeth, who said, "And I will help you." And so, we don't die alone, as we would fear, but we either are greeted by, if my wife dies before me, I'm sure I'll be greeted by my wife, our relatives who have passed, or in children who often don't have those types of, something that means something to them, to assist them in this process.
One thing that strikes me is that children are unlikely to to have been indoctrinated into these things. They don't necessarily expect a noodle example that they're going up through. Do you find that the religious background made a difference? I mean, obviously in the way they phrase it, I can imagine it would, do people have the same experience regardless of their background, more or less?
Yes. You know, I think that this is challenging. And Martin, you and I have, you know that I am now a Christian. In fact, I'm a Mormon after I've been baptized as a Mormon, and a great deal a part of my experiences. So I think it's challenging for all of us who have a deep faith that the experience itself does not seem to depend on a given religion. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. One girl who we resuscitated, her family had no religious beliefs whatsoever. And she told me that when we resuscitated her, that there were three doctors. And I said to her, well, how did you know they were doctors? And she said, oh, they were 14 feet tall and they had light bulbs in their bodies, just like all the doctors. And she said that they told her to press a button on a machine. And if she pressed the green button, she could go with them. But she would never see her family again. And so she pressed the red button and she returned to consciousness. So that's basically the same experience. You know, there's some sort of a being in light. She felt she was very loved, that these she felt safe, she felt trusted, in these three, let's face it, she's describing angels. But from her lack of religious background, she called them doctors. And she, again, had the same decision that Crystal Merzlach had to make. Does she want to come back to be with her family, or is she going to go with them? And yet there's no religious elements in this experience at all. In fact, of the 24 that we studied in our formal study from Seattle Children's Hospital, about 14 of them were simply experiences of a loving light. You know, just one boy, so poetic. He said, I saw a light that had all of the energy and all the sounds of the universe inside of it, and it rang as clear as a bell, but it rang so loud, but the aware only thought they could hear it, and the unaware can't hear it at all. Mm-hmm. And I always think of, when they talk about the faint thing of angels. I think that was a very beautiful description of what, we as adults call the faint thing of angels. Mm-hmm. So I think, we have to understand that everyone is going to have this experience. And I think that we have to have a very inclusive understanding of religion.
One of the things that troubles some people about near-death experiences is that they hear these odd kinds of descriptions, the noodle, and we can understand that with a little kid. Crystal Merzlach said, he's crawling up through this tunnel and it was made of colored bricks. And you're thinking, is there really a stonemason that makes this tunnel between heaven and earth? And you talked about the other child who had a green button or a red button. Well, is when you leave, is there really a button that you can push to go or a button you can push to stay? And I've come to the conclusion that these are not earthly experiences. And so people are using the best analogy that they can come up with to describe the kind of event that they had. And one of the examples from near-death experiences that we often have are people are told they can stay or come back. Some say, I knew if I went beyond this river, I couldn't come back. Or some say, if I crossed this bridge, I couldn't come back. Or if I went beyond this wall, or if I opened this door and went through it. These are all earthly metaphors for what they're experiencing there. I'm not sure that there's a real something like a wall or a border or a mist that if you go to the other side of it. These are all kind of earthly analogies to talk about the other side, maybe the same way that, you see descriptions of deity in the Old and New Testaments, you know, brighter than the noonday sun, or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, I've got two. I want to just tell you one a quick comment, and then I have a lengthier response. Our formal study of survivors of cardiac arrest at the Seattle Children's Hospital, 24 out of 26 of our patients had this experience. But one young man, we asked him, we always asked him this sort of bland, open-ended question, you know, what do you remember about the time that you were sick, or, you know, whatever's appropriate for them. And he looked at us, and his eyes just opened wide, and his eyes sort of darted back and forth, and his face just shined with happiness and joy. And then he just shrugged his shoulders, and he said nothing. So, this being a scientific study, we had to put him down as not having an experience. but you know, clearly he had something. You know, so this speaks to your point, Martin, that, you know, that he had something that he simply had no words for. But I think the important issue that we have to understand is that this, what you're calling this earthly reality, is a spiritual reality. We have to understand that these are spiritual experiences, and that, so of course, you know, each person is going to describe it as they will, and yet there still is a commonality to them. Now, for example, with Crystal Merzlach, I quizzed her parents very closely on what they had taught her about what happens to us when we die. And, there was no, they didn't say, oh, well, we taught her that she's going to be in a tunnel lined with bricks and meet a woman named Elizabeth. You know, they taught her, you know, the typical Mormon doctrine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, her experience was different than what she had been taught. And yet, it's exactly what you're saying, Martin, is that she's struggling to explain as best she can a profound spiritual experience. And it really makes me, or has caused me, to see the spiritual dimension of life everywhere around. I think that what we're facing now is a spiritual challenge. You know, when this is all over, how we treat each other, you know, how we love or don't love each other, is all that's going to be important about what we're going through. Yeah. And that we're here to learn lessons. And that this is a spiritual reality. And I think that that's the best way to understand, you know, those who are struggling with, well, wait a minute, this person described heaven this way, and this person said heaven looked like that. Well, you know, they're not describing a city in this earth. They're describing a different realm of reality.
One common factor that I've seen in accounts, and I've read a fair number of them, is people are saying, well, there were colors there that I can't describe. Things that are unlike anything I've ever seen, or there was music, and it was sort of like X, but it was sort of like Y, and I can't really describe what it was like, and, you know, that sort of thing. And then the other thing that occurs to me, too, is just whenever we travel, if two people go to, I don't know, France, and you ask them, well, what was it like? You're going to get very different accounts. It doesn't mean that France is fictional.
Yes, of course.
But they're explaining what they saw and what they experienced in different ways. Maybe they don't even see all the same things, but they'll have different ways of expressing even what they did see.
Because this loving light, this God that we encounter, has as many facets as there are human beings. Mm-hmm. And each one of us has our own individual relationship with God. And so, of course, that's a beautiful, you know, I've not really heard it explained the way you just did, but that's a beautiful insight. You know, no different than if we all went to visit New York City. Each one of us is going to have a very different experience there.
Right.
So I agree with what you're saying. I wanted to come back to the first comment, though, about how they see colors that they've never seen before, et cetera. I did most of my training as a neuroscientist. I did, a fellowship in pediatrics, and then I trained as a neuroscientist to try to understand how the brain works and how can we have these experiences given what we know with what the brain works. So a lot of times people think, well, the brain is creating these experiences. Mm-hmm. That, you know, somehow, you know, when we die, that, you know, some wiring in our brain has gone wrong. But what you just mentioned, that I've heard the, exactly what you described, that, you know, they see colors that they can't describe, that they've never seen before. I've heard children say, you know, I was in heaven and I saw all the flowers, but of course I can't describe the colors to you. That tells us that our brain is more of a filter than it is the creator. That, you know, that it's a filter. It's something that, you know, that all of reality is too much for us. And so it has to be filtered through our brain. And when our brain dies, then we're free of that filter. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you hear these descriptions, you know, then that really rings true. That really explains why they see colors that we can't see, given the limitations of how our nervous system works, what our retina perceives, and how our brain interprets color in this reality.
Right. My wife showed me something just yesterday, I think, that was purporting to show how a bee sees flowers. What they would look like to a bee. Mm. I have no idea how we would know what they look like to a bee, but they were vividly colored, but quite unlike the way they would appear to us. And I just realized
exactly
that everything I'm looking at, I'm seeing just a tiny fragment of the spectrum. Ultraviolet, infrared, all these things are beyond my capacity to see. What if I could see all of those? What would it look like? I have
yes.
no idea.
Well, you know, you will, though. and I've talked to children. Now, you know, the one young man who couldn't describe his experience, you could see it on his face that he was seeing things that he simply could not put into words whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, when we're finally free from, because we need this brain, we need this body. How else can we learn our lessons of love? How else can we interact with each other? How else can we communicate with each other unless we're able to sort of dummy down reality? And that's a beautiful example that you give. You know, for example, dogs can often smell odors miles away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they have a very different reality than we do, because they have a very different brain than we do. So we're not creating reality, but it's that we exist in this spiritual reality, and our brains are what we use to interpret it as best we can.
One of the things that illustrates the point that Dan and Melvin, that you're both talking about here, is there have been some books. One of them is Mindsight that I like, that has descriptions of near-death experiences in people who were totally blind, and those people have the same kind of experience that you're kind of describing for sighted people going to heaven and seeing something that they have never seen before on earth. People who are blind who've had near-death experiences will see because they don't have the physical limitations, but they struggle to describe things that are ordinary for us because they have not seen them before. And it's really interesting. One lady who had been totally and completely blind since birth, she had never seen anything at all, described her near-death experience to me and said, I could see, but it took me a while to figure out what that was, because I had never seen before. And I finally realized it because I could see my wedding ring, which I had touched so many times, and I knew what it felt like, and I finally equated the look to the touch that I had experienced. And so for her, any sight was beyond what she had experienced. And these are the kinds of things that people could not make this up. They just could not make it up.
Well, and even beyond that, Martin, I've got to tell you that, you know, from the neuroscientist point of view, that absolutely authenticates the near-death experience, because we know that people who are blind from birth, and then for whatever reason, medical science or whatever, their sight is suddenly restored. Interestingly enough, they have to learn how to see. They don't just suddenly, see everything. They have to learn to see. And so just as you're describing this woman who was blind from birth, in her near-death experience, she had to learn. She had to try, to finally understand what this experience was. And so, we can't leave this issue of whether they're real or not and what people see during the experience unless we talk about, I think, one of the most powerful pieces of evidence that these experiences are real, which is when experiencers, children and adults, see things that they could not otherwise see.
Right.
For example, one young man told me that when he drew this great picture of him actually walking towards this tunnel and then the tunnel going towards a rainbow. All the children drew me beautiful pictures, but over to the side, in an adjoining waiting room, he described his mother and his grandmother, his grandfather hugging. And he said, look, that's my mom and my grandfather, and they're hugging and they're crying. And there is absolutely no way he could have seen that, nor could he have known that his grandfather's appearance in the hospital was completely unexpected. Nobody knew that the grandfather was going to show up until he just showed up. And yet this young boy, after he came out of his experience, he described it. So clearly, those anecdotes, if you will, document that these experiences are real.
They do. In a nutshell, all of these are people coming back from a near-death experience and having information that they literally did not have before. So it couldn't have just come from their mind.
Beautifully
their
put,
brain.
Martin.
They got new information that they did not have before. And you can verify it,
absolutely.
And that's a proof or a strong evidence.
For some reason, I'm thinking of a story that was told to me years and years ago by someone whose name I can't even remember now, but he was working at the time as a technician, laboratory technician or something at the University of Utah Medical Center. And it was during the time of when you may remember the case of Barney Clark, who had the world's first artificial heart. And it was a big machine, basically. It was not a very user-friendly sort of thing. He was stuck in his hospital bed. He couldn't go anywhere without that machine. But this fellow told me, he says, between you and me, he said, it got to be sort of spooky around there. And the university hospital didn't even want us talking about this sort of thing, because they were already drawing criticism for that case. But he said there were cases where, for example, a lab tech or a nurse would come into Barney Clark's room, and he'd say, "Oh, you ought to be more careful. I saw you drop that bottle in the, in the lab there." And, it was a couple of floors away in another wing or something, and they just said, "Good grief! Yeah. He's wandering the halls watching us." Or he'd say to a doctor, "Oh, I see you got a new car. Well, how'd you know that?" "Well, I saw it out in the parking lot." Well, he couldn't see the parking lot from where he was.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that I just find impossible to explain on any naturalistic theory of consciousness.
Yeah. And there is no way. But I love the way you framed this, Martin. I always learn something when I talk to you, because what you framed it as that they come back with information that they didn't have before. So some of that information is like we were talking about, seeing a doctor's car in the parking lot. Seeing a grandfather who, there's no reason for the young man to have known that his grandfather was going to be there. But a lot of this information is the little girl I told you she saw her grandmother, and then she clenched her fists and tried to say, "And I'm trying to figure out what it means to be back to." She told me, she said, "I'm not afraid to die." And I asked her, I said, "Why? This horrible traumatic thing happened to you?" And she said, "Well, because I know a little bit more about it now."
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she came back with information too, information that she didn't have, you know, what the dying process is like. And the faith that these children have when they grow up to be adults is profound. They don't grow, you know, we can talk, you know, they don't become atheists. I'll tell you that much. They all become intensely spiritual. They come back with an absolute conviction that there is a God and that there's a purpose for this life. And that purpose may be, I interviewed one, we did this, Martin knows, a study of adults who had near-death experiences as children, and we also studied the children as they grew up. And I was interviewing this one young man who had had a near-death experience 15 years before, and he said that he had been told that to go back, you know, to Earth, because he had a job to do. So, you know, I was much younger then, and I was still sort of in that you know, that doctor knows everything phase of my life. And so I'm like, oh, God, you know, he's going to tell me he came back for a cure to cancer or to start a religion or, you know, and I sort of rolled my eyes. And he looked at me and he said, no, Dr. Morse, I already told you what my job was. And he ran a small construction company that did remodeling. And he had hired his high school friends to work. And he felt very strongly that if he wasn't, you know, leading this company, and that's what he felt his job was, you know, that he came back to be, you know, very ordinary guy running a remodeling, you know, a small remodeling company. Mm-hmm. And so it teaches us that our lives are important. Each one of our lives is important, no matter what you know, how humble or how exalted it may be. And again, as you said, Martin, it's because he came back with this information he didn't have before, the absolute conviction that his job was his mission in life. But it wasn't to cure cancer. It was to, you know, hire his high school buddies and provide them with, you know, with employment.
That's a great story. One of the ineffable descriptions that I really like comes from a nurse from the Midwest named Erica McKenzie. And I was hearing from her near-death experience, and she said, God gives every one of us gifts or talents. And when I had my experience, I saw them on this great conveyor belt going through the universe. And there's a package, just like a Christmas package, wrapped up for each one of us. And I thought to myself, is there literally a conveyor belt going through the universe with wrapped up packages with bows on it? You know, I thought, no, this is a wonderful analogy from an adult, not just a kid, but this is a description from an RN, from a nurse who couldn't find a better way than that description, which I absolutely love, to describe this idea of talents or gifts from God, which was the kind of a message that she said she really needed, because she was struggling to understand the value of her life and of everyone's life, and to put together the meaning of life. But I thought that was great. So when I hear about a red button or a green button or packages through the universe, none of that bothers me, because I see these as all different ways to try to explain something that can't be explained in our ordinary language.
But even, you know, building on that, you know, because we know that the Bible itself, much of the Bible is language that inspires us spiritually, and yet it doesn't necessarily, you know, refer to any given physical reality. And I want to build on that. I heard a very similar story, but the thrust of the story that this experience, this was an adult that came back, was that too often people aren't receiving those packages. In her case, it wasn't packages. She saw sort of like, I guess the best way I could understand it was God was sending people post-it notes with messages. And there was a sense of frustration that people weren't getting those messages. And I think that that's a challenge that we all have, that, you know, that we need to understand that our lives are important, that we need to learn to listen to God. We need to learn how to find God in our lives. And from my own self, you know, knowing that near-death experiences are real, knowing that this experience, that this God that people perceive as real, then gives me the courage because otherwise, you know, as you know, we all struggle with faith. We're all kind of wondering, you know, what does this all mean, you know? And it gives me the courage to believe my own faith.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems to me that all of us have to ask ourselves the question once in a while, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? I'm furiously busy.
Yes.
Is this the thing I'm supposed to be doing? And maybe we need to pause and listen and find out that we're supposed to be doing something else. Or maybe this is what we're supposed to be doing. We should see it as our mission. Like you say, running a construction business might be the mission.
Yeah. Well, particularly, you know, I was really excited about talking tonight because my family and my friends are struggling to understand what's going on right now. And, you know, and there's a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety. And, we've sort of isolated. My wife is she has severe lung disease, so she would be at high risk of getting this virus. My brother and his wife have isolated themselves. And yet this is a time then where we have to learn to turn our worries into prayers, to turn our anxieties into establishing this reality with God. You know, we don't need to wait to have our near-death experience, in other words. Well, that's what, you know, we need to learn from these near-death experiences, not only the good news that there is a reality beyond this one that we're going to enter into, but that we can have this experience while we're still alive.
You know, sometimes we learn through crises. I mean, I was talking to my wife today about how sometimes we get furiously busy and then some disaster hits us, you know, the death of a loved one or something. And suddenly all the things that worried you, that concerned you the day before, you realize are trivial. They just don't matter. There are certain things that really do, but we're usually not focused on those.
Right. All the petty little stuff between me and my brother, all the, we know from the Bible that we should, you know, make amends with our brother before you even go to the temple.
Right.
And yet, those things, you know, my brother, you know, I'm 66, he's 68. We've got a lifetime of arguments and unresolved conflicts, etc. And yet, since this has happened, we have been talking on the phone every day.
Yeah.
And everything that we thought was so important, every wound, every grievous argument that you know, I was right and he was wrong, has just as you said, has just vanished. And we really understand that it's our love that is important.
Well, that's a great message. We've got about 2 minutes left. Any parting thoughts, Dr. Morse, for our listeners?
Wow. Ultimately, this is an issue of faith. I think that, I encourage, to not just look at this as a scientific issue, but to look within. And to see if you can find the faith to believe what these children tell us, because it seems to me that there's so many, you know, when I hear the arguments of skeptics, Martin, you know, as you know, they're these long, convoluted, extensive arguments against a child who just says, "I saw God," and he had a lot of good things to tell me. And, you know, so Occam's razor, for those, tells us that the simplest answer is the correct one. and we need to listen to these children and bring this wisdom into our lives.
It's been an absolute delight to have you with us on Interpreter Radio, and we thank you so much for sharing your insights into near-death experiences and also how to apply them in our current situation of crisis with the coronavirus. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome, and I always learn something in talking with you, Martin. It's just a pleasure. It's really nice to meet you, Dan. I hope that when I'm in Salt Lake City, you know, I'll be able to meet you in person.
That would be great. Yeah, I'd look forward to that.
We will do that. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Oh, you're so welcome. Yep. Bye-bye.
And there we go. And that's 8 o'clock. We'll be back on the other side of this break with more Interpreter Radio and our Come Follow Me lesson. I'm Martin Tanner in studio with Professor Daniel Peterson. We'll be right back.
You're listening to K-Talk Radio, KBJA 1640.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Here we are for our second hour of Interpreter Radio. I'm Martin Tanner in studio. With me is Dan Peterson, Professor Daniel Peterson, who is the founder of the Interpreter Foundation. And before we talk more about Come Follow Me for this particular lesson, which is Mosiah chapters 7 through 10, Dan, let's tell people a bit about the Interpreter Foundation, and then I'll tell them about our sponsor, Cruise Lady.
Well, the Interpreter Foundation is a group that was started back in August of 2012. And what we decided to do as our first effort was to launch an online journal. It was really, really kind of fun to do because we entered an era where it was possible to do that kind of thing. I had found before when I was involved with the old Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, or FARMS, that we published books, we published journals and so on, but they were expensive. I remember talking to some people in Perth, Western Australia, and in Perth, you know, the joke there was, this is not the ends of the earth, but you can see the ends of the earth from here. Or the other joke was that you're so far away from church headquarters in Perth that if you keep going further, you're getting closer, which is just about literally true. But their complaint was that any printed materials over there were they were so expensive because, as I understand it, at least at that time, there'd be the import duties, which about doubled the cost of the book. The import costs, and then the import duties, which tripled the cost of a book or a journal, which meant that, you know, if it were a book that was $20 in the United States, it would be the equivalent of $60 in Australia, which made it prohibitive. But Interpreter was able to arise in an area where we didn't have to adjust to online life. We started as an online organization, so our materials, including this radio show, are put online at no cost. People can get them in Perth or wherever they are at no extra charge. It's as convenient to be in Perth or in Nairobi as it is to be in Provo. And so that's an exciting thing. So we've had this journal going for now almost 8 years, over 400 consecutive weeks of publication online, all at no charge. The radio program, the blog, conferences, we've published books, we've done one short film, and are now doing a major not just a film, but a complex of films. About the witnesses, which we hope will come out in October. That was the goal. Now, who knows, given the coronavirus, but we're still aiming at October for release of that film, The Witnesses. But anyway, lots of exciting things.
Tell our listeners also about Come Follow Me and some of the archived scriptural roundtables that we have.
What we've done, and we've been doing it as part of this radio show for quite a while now.
And as Hangouts before then.
Right, the Google Hangouts. We've generated a lot of material commenting on the reading passages for gospel doctrine classes, going back through more than one cycle. It's been going on for a long time. And as the technology has evolved, it's gotten a little better too, I think. But the plan has been simply to get together people who might have interesting things to say and have them talk about the reading, that is being discussed. And so those are available, not just live on the radio show now, but they're archived, stripped of commercial and other interruptions, and put there online for free. Anyone can access them on the interpreter website and listen to discussions of whatever he or she is going to be studying or teaching next.
Which, it strikes me, is particularly something of value during these times when you're not going to church physically. You can study at home, and this is a great study aid that hopefully will have added meaning when people are limited to studying at home.
Yeah, I'm excited about what we can do now that we couldn't have done just a very short while ago, and now it's relatively easy to do, and we're doing it. So Interpreter has become a multimedia operation. Even our journal articles are recorded in audio, so if someone wants to listen to them while walking or jogging, that's possible. They're available on different platforms. They're available in print on demand at cost. We can't do that for free, but we don't make anything from it either. Just order it and it comes to you. So we're doing all this to get the word out there as much as we can. So we depend on donations to support the funding that we need. We don't charge where we don't have to, which means almost nowhere.
Which is a wonderful thing. And we should also thank the sponsor who pays for these particular programs to happen, and that would be Cruise Lady Latter-day Adventures, which allows people to explore the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Their request is to join the Interpreter Foundation on some of its unique cruises and tours. One of the ones that they're focusing on now is the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson, who is in studio right now. This one is scheduled for November 20th of this year, November 20th, 2020. And if you go, you will see the best of Egypt, from the pyramids of Giza to the temples of Luxor and Karnak, Valley of the Kings, and the absolutely magnificent temple of Ramses II. Space is limited, so call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or for more information at cruiselady.com. Again, that's 801-453-9444 or on the internet, cruiselady.com.
You know, I want to say, too, that I'm really excited about that tour. My wife and I spent our first four years of married life living in Egypt, and we go back pretty frequently, and I'm delighted to go back on this one, and I especially like the timing because it won't be hot. Typically, lately, when I take tours there, it's in May, and oh my, it can be blistering when you get down to places like Luxor and Aswan. But in November, late November, it's going to be really, really pleasant. So that'll be fun.
It will be absolutely wonderful. And with that, we should turn our attention to Come Follow Me. And this particular lesson is Mosiah chapters 7 through 10. And let's jump into this. Do you want to give a short little intro to this?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't prepared anything, but I can just say that what happens in this story is that Ammon, who's sent out to try to find what happened to the people who went back to the land of Lehi and Nephi, that is the land of the first inheritance, the first place where Lehi's colony lived, that was abandoned by the Nephites under Lamanite pressure years before. There was a group that had gone back to resettle that land. Now they're wondering, what happened to them? Where are they? Did they survive? They get wiped out, something like that. So Ammon is sent to find them, and let me just say something about it. He has a hard time finding them. And one of the themes in this little section is people go out in the wilderness and they get lost. They can't find things, which is really interesting to me. You can believe what you want about where the Book of Mormon took place, but I'll tell you, I've been down in the jungles in Mesoamerica, and you step 10 or 20 feet into them, you can't tell where you are. You're totally lost. Unless you're one of the native Indians, they can read the the moss and all that sort of thing, tell directions, but good grief, it's confusing. And you can't see anything. You just can't see a thing. Well, at one point, I remember we were walking with archaeologists within a few feet. Well, they said, do you see the sort of slope over there to the right? And I said, yeah. You know, and it looked green and covered with plants like everything else around me did. And they said, that's a temple. That's a pyramid. I said, seriously? Yeah, it's just covered with plants and trees. It's been excavated, and then the next year you come back and it's covered again. And so there's just all sorts of things out there that I couldn't see at all. It's easy to get lost. And the other thing I'll say about the complexity of Mosiah itself, it's full of these groups that split off. Then they rejoin. Then they get lost. Then they come together like the resolution of a chord at the end where everybody comes together. I asked a class, I don't teach Book of Mormon or religion classes very often, but I did once at BYU teach this section of the Book of Mormon. And I said, okay, I'll give you an assignment for extra credit. Diagram or outline the action in the Book of Mosiah alone. It's really complicated. And, I'm thinking, and here's Joseph Smith is dictating this at the clip of about 8.5 to 11 pages a day in English text. He just made this up on the fly? Are you kidding me? How could you keep the details straight without having a written text before you, which we know he did not? So, anyway, a general statement about Mosiah and about Mosiah 7.
Great, great comments. I've often had a similar idea that this is so complex. How would you ever keep it straight? And it would just be impossible. You couldn't do it. Another thing I'd like to get your impressions of before we jump into the lesson proper is this section, because of Ammon and the group going up to this place, has something to say about the scope and scale of the lands here, which I think would be remiss if we didn't mention, because there are still to this day some people that think Book of Mormon, land northward, that's North America, land southward, that's all of South America, or something to that scale.
Yeah. Well, that's the obvious first thought you have. You look at a map of the Western Hemisphere, there's a land northward and a land southward connected by a narrow neck of land. Yeah, that's got to be the whole thing. But when you read the Book of Mormon itself, you realize the distances are not huge. They're just not that big. They're not traveling for months, Lewis and Clark style, across North America or anything like that. These are relatively short distances. They get lost, so that sometimes costs time. But they're not vast distances. And I think that's one of the great eye-openers of John Sorensen's work, is to go through and just tabulate the distance. And they're never more than a few hundred miles, a few days' journey, west, north, east, south.
And here you have Ammon, and they're going from Nephite territory to Lamanite territory, and they don't even know where they're going, and so they're kind of apparently meandering around. Yeah. And it still is less than a month. This is not some huge amount of time.
Yeah, the distances can't be great. So people mock, what they call the limited geography. Oh, it's limited. That's beyond question. Once you read the Book of Mormon carefully, it is definitely a limited geography. The question is where to put it. But it's not a continental or hemispheric geography.
Right. And it's funny that people would want to make it that large because virtually everything you find described in the Bible, the Old and the New Testaments, happened within several hundred miles. This is also not a huge area either. If you go from Egypt up to Palestine, that's about the extent of it.
I think it's one of the eye-openers for a lot of people. I've led tours to Israel for a cruise lady for about 10 or 12 years. I don't know how long now. Going there at least once a year, sometimes twice, three times. And people are shocked by how small it is and how the famous Old Testament stories are kind of overlaid on the New Testament stories, vice versa. That this thing you thought was a big New Testament story happened about 1,000 yards from where the famous Old Testament stories are placed. It's a very small area. Big stories don't require large areas. They can be big stories in even small spaces.
That's exactly right. One of the other examples, which really doesn't pertain to Mosiah, but I'll tell it anyway in 10 seconds here, was when I first did a little looking into how big was Jerusalem when Isaiah was running around prophesying. And I don't remember the exact number, but the gist of it was that everybody living in Jerusalem and surrounding areas could easily fit into the new conference center with room to spare. So, you know, it doesn't have to be incredible numbers of people for something very, very important, like the book of Isaiah and the prophet Isaiah's message to show up and be valid for us.
So I'd say when you see references to kings, the Lamanite king and the king of the small Nephite colony, don't be thinking, you know, monarch of England or something like that. These were, you know, chieftains of maybe a complex of small, we'd consider them villages. Frankly.
Yep. Exactly so. All right. Mosiah 7 through 10. The first chapter here has King Mosiah, and just as you mentioned, it says in verse 1, desirous to know concerning the people who went up to dwell in the land of Lehi-Nephi, or in the city of Lehi-Nephi. So this is a land as well as a city, and then they go there. And this is not some huge, great expedition. Verse 2 tells us that Mosiah granted that 16 of their strong men might go up. So this is not a huge, huge party, as you mentioned. And from there, Ammon leaves, and they travel in verse 4. It says, even 40 days did they wander, and that's an interesting number because that's kind of real indefinite. That's not literally, you know, necessarily 40 days. That means a while.
40 just was a big number, you know, but 40 days and 40 nights of the flood, and Jesus fasted for 40 days, and Alibaba and the 40 thieves, and, you know, in the Middle East, in Middle Eastern idioms, 40 it's a big number, but right. It's not years.
That's right, and it's a little bit like today we say, not in a million years will this ever, you know, it's not literally a million years. Okay. Verse 6 says that Ammon took three of his brethren, and he mentions their names, and they go and they meet the king. These are three that he takes, and they're brought before the king, and there's a description here of how the king and his guards are unhappy with them for showing up where he felt like he could have been in peril, but then things get a little bit better for them.
Yeah, but you can see why. He's nervous when he explains the situation. They're under constant siege from the Lamanites. They're on high alert, so whenever these strangers are sort of loitering around outside, they've got to figure initially hostile intent until they learn otherwise. So it all becomes clear. Again, it's good storytelling. It sounds plausible.
It does to me as well. And it also sounds plausible, but not something that a still quite young Joseph Smith would have any experience with.
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy in his early 20s when he produces the Book of Mormon. He would know nothing about warfare or about the way, you know, villages or kingdoms might interact. These kinds of things just leap out at me as I consider where the Book of Mormon came from.
Yeah. You know, reading it today, it hit me once again. Once in a while I hear critics say, oh, you know, I read it and see instantly it's illogical, it doesn't make any sense, but my reaction today, again, yet again, was just the opposite. I thought, this reads so plausibly. This reads like real story. This happened. You know, that hits me almost every time I read the Book of Mormon.
And another thing that always comes to mind when I read the Book of Mormon is the fascinating intermixture of ancient ideas with modern English. You have, and Van and I were talking about this, Van Hale, for those who are listening, so they'll know the reference. We're talking about this in an earlier broadcast where we were discussing how it is that you can have Joseph Smith's style and descriptions in a book like this, and yet having it come from God. And there are two ideas that seem to be the extremes. One is that God dictated absolutely every single word, or maybe every single letter, if you want to look at some of the Whitmer descriptions, or that, gee, Joseph Smith had these concepts come into his mind and he just kind of described them freeform. And I've always thought that whichever direction you want to push this, and, you know, Royal Skousen might be on one end, and you might have somebody like Blake Osler on the other end, but you cannot deny that there is God in the Book of Mormon, and you cannot deny that there is Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon either. There's a human element as well as a divine element in the Book of Mormon.
There's a wonderful passage from Brigham Young. I wish I wasn't thinking about it, so I don't have the reference with me. There's no such thing as a perfect revelation, because inevitably a revelation has to come through a human mind and be perceived by a human mind. And we're just, God is perfect, but we're not. And so, yeah, there's going to be a human element. It's like Jesus, you know, coming down as the second person of the Godhead, but taking upon himself human form. He looked like a Palestinian Jew of the first century, so much so that Judas had to pick him out in the crowd, right, to show who to arrest. He didn't look that. He didn't glow. He didn't walk six inches off the ground, you know, things like that. So he is, yes, he's deity and he's human. This is divine and it's human. It's a blend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as we move on with our story in Mosiah 7, let's talk about some of the things that we find here. The king here becomes thrilled when he finds out who they really are, and he takes away their bonds. But as we move on to discuss some of the things that happen here and how he eventually acquires these 24 gold plates, let's talk about some of the concepts here. First of all, the Nephites in verse 15 are paying tribute to the king of the Lamanites, and we're shown here how this is very unjust and so on and so forth. But then you move on to verse 17, and it talks about the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And we've, as we're reading through the Book of Mormon, see temple in, I think, one of the first references is 2 Nephi, chapter 5, verse 16, or if I remember right. And there are several other places, but when people think of temple here, this would not be the Salt Lake Temple.
Right.
This would not be the temple in Jerusalem as it was at the time of Jesus. What, Professor Peterson, do we know to some limited extent? Obviously, we can't know too much about what this temple might have been like and what the reference to temple here means.
Well, if it's anything like some of the other ancient temples we know, it would have had a courtyard, which would have been a good place for public announcements, probably by far the largest, you know, the largest building in the city or town or village. So it would have been the focal point, and maybe literally so. I remember a story that my friend Kent Brown told me about entertaining a friend of his, Yigal Yadin, who was a very, very famous Israeli archaeologist. And he also happened to be, at one point, the chief of staff of the army in the 48 War of Independence. He went on to become deputy prime minister, so a really prominent guy, but mainly an archaeologist. And he came and visited BYU and gave an address at BYU in the 60s, I think. Kent Brown, who had been his research assistant at Brown University, Kent was in grad school, was his host. And he took him to Temple Square. We often do that when a visitor comes in. And Yadin was especially fascinated by the fact that all the streets were numbered from Temple Square. He said, wow, I haven't seen a layout like this where a community was literally centered on the temple since the late Bronze Age. You know, he just thought that was really cool. Yeah. It was ancient Israel reborn on the, you know, on the valley floor of Salt Lake Valley, and I thought that was really an interesting insight.
Yeah, it would take somebody with his background to come up with that insight.
Yes. But, you know, the fact is the temple is the center of the village, the center of the town, and but again, with a large open air. You see these ancient temples, you know, the temple in Jerusalem, both the Solomonic temple and the later Herodian temple. The temple proper is a, you know, it's a large building, but relative to the rest of the temple complex, it's small. So there would have been a huge open area there to bring people to make an announcement.
You know, I'm trying to throw you a few softball pitches, you know, really slow right over the plate here. But another one that I'd like to toss out here now is critics sometimes will say, well, Book of Mormon couldn't be an ancient book because there just weren't any temples outside of the one in Jerusalem. But we now know that absolutely not to be true, right, and have for quite some time.
That's a really softball question. Thank you. there were Israelite temples at the north and the south of the country. Still go to Tel Dan, that really wonderfully named site, up the very northern boundary of Israel. Go south to Beersheba. There's a temple there, Tel Arad. There's a temple just discovered within the past few months in a village just outside of Jerusalem, not more than a few miles outside of Jerusalem. Very puzzling, and it, you know, was staffed by apparently legitimate Levitical priests. I mean, until maybe the time of Hezekiah, there were multiple temples. And here's the one I really love.
Really puzzling, just kind of like the Jordan River Temple and its proximity to the Salt Lake Temple. So just how do you...
You know, I was living in Israel when the Jordan River Temple was announced, and I have to confess, your frame of reference affects how you hear the news. So I'm living in Jerusalem, right, and I hear the news pre-internet, that somehow the news arrives that there's going to be a new Jordan River Temple, and I remember thinking, but we don't even have very many members here. It dawned on me, oh, it has to be the one in Utah.
Yeah.
But one of my most fun experiences, where I think a lot of people probably thought I was some sort of loon, was we were in Aswan once, taking a tour there. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't before I was doing Cruise Lady. And we went to have lunch on an island in the north, Aswan. And I suddenly realized that the island just across, maybe 100 yards away, was Elephantine Island. And this was the south end of Elephantine Island. We were looking, and I said, people, stop. Before you get off the boat to go to the restaurant, look at that island across the way. That is a Book of Mormon site. Now, you may be asking, are you nuts? This is southern Egypt. How can it be a Book of Mormon site? There was a temple there built in the 400s by Jews with the authorization of the high priest in Jerusalem. There was a Jewish military complement there, mercenaries probably. They got permission to build a small temple on Elephantine Island. It's gone now, but we have the documents from it. We still have the records of a Saraya who contributed money to the building and upkeep of the temple. Same name as Lehi has. So when people say the Book of Mormon can't be true because there's a temple outside of Jerusalem, they don't know what they're talking about. They simply don't know.
They simply don't. Should we move on with our story, of Mosiah 7?
Well, one thing I get a kick out of, by the way, is when immediately the king says, wow, now we're going to be saved. I think it's 16 guys.
Yeah. That shows the scale of... Yeah. What's going
but
on?
But he's really thrilled. He's really thrilled. And he announces to his people, you know, verse 19, rejoice and put your trust in God, in that God who is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and also that God who brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, which is always the archetypal image of deliverance. You know, they always think back. That's what Passover is about. Jews today still look back to that. So they look back to that, but they've had another one, verse 20. That same God has brought our fathers out of the land of Jerusalem. So this is a God who saves people. His people, he saves them out of dire straits, which you could argue is maybe the great theme of the gospel. You know, that Jesus, and this is all pointing to Jesus who comes and saves us out of bondage. So,
one of the great themes of the Book of Mormon and also of the Bible is deliverance. And I remember teaching gospel doctrine maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, and somebody raised their hand and said, so exactly how many times have the Jews been scattered and restored? And I had to think, that's a really good question. It took me a while to think about that, but as I remember, it's been at least 6 or 7 different times, but it's a theme that happens over and over again from, you know, Egypt clear down to the time when they were ostensibly, you know, restored by the horse and hide prayer.
Yeah. So, you know, there's still gathering, you could say. It's still going on with Israel today.
Do you have a comment, and I don't want to get too far afield from all of the spiritual messages here, but another place that critics might comment would be in verse 22. They would say, well, this talks about a tribute to the king of the Lamanites from corn, which is understandable. Hey, we're in the New World. But barley and flocks and herds, what would we say about barley and flocks and herds? I have some ideas here, but I'd be very interested in your thoughts here.
Well, pre-Columbian barley has, in fact, been found. That was one of the things that people used to hold against the Book of Mormon. But you have to check that one off the list. It has been located. And then, you know, grain of every kind. We don't know what they had in mind by grain, though we'll see a list of it in one of the next chapters in this section. And one half of the increase of our flocks and our herds. Again, we don't know what animals those are. There's been speculation about what kind of animals the Lehites, the Nephites, and Lamanites eventually had. We just don't know in some cases. We have lists of names. Some of them are mysterious. Kurlams, Kumams. We don't know what they were. Presumably they're things for which Joseph has no name.
Yes. Yeah.
So
maybe llamas, alpacas, yeah. Something similar to that, of which Joseph Smith would have no knowledge whatsoever.
Yeah. He didn't even have a word in English, and I'm not sure at that time whether a word existed in the English language. I can't say, but if you would look at a dictionary, when is the first appearance of alpaca in English?
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if it were after 1830.
Right. So as we move along with the story here, there are descriptions about hearkening unto the words of God. And then in verse 26, we have this description about a prophet of the Lord have they slain. And then it goes on and describes the coming of Christ. And in verse 27, I wanted to read this because there are people who think, well, Joseph Smith just came up with a Book of Mormon. But as you read this description of Jesus, this is not a Trinitarian view.
Right.
And it frankly isn't even the way Latter-day Saints would describe Jesus today. This is a little bit different kind of a model, which to me doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's a different way of looking at it. And I'd like to read it here, verse 27. And because he said unto them that Christ was the God, the Father of all things, and it goes on from there, we typically don't describe Christ as God and the Father of all things, although that's not inaccurate. It's a different way of describing God than we would have today.
Yeah. You know, I think it's not unlikely that the Nephites had, you know, they didn't have all the revelations available to them that we have available to us. And so they might have viewed these things very differently. They might not have had the same clear notion of Father and Son that we have. They certainly could have conceived it differently than we do. And I don't think we ought to be shocked at that. In fact, we ought to expect that. That if you were to meet an ancient Nephite, supposing by some miraculous means you could talk to one another easily, you would find that his way of thinking is very different from yours.
Even as if you go back and look at pioneer journals and journals from people in Joseph Smith era,
yeah,
they looked at things significantly different in some ways than we do today. We often say the gospel is the same yesterday, today, and forever, but there are also some differences yesterday, today, and in the future.
There's an opening line of a novel that I've ran across. I've never read the novel. I can't even remember what it is, but the opening line is such a good one. I can't imagine the novel could live up to it. It says, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there.
I like that. That's wonderful. That's a great comment. Let's wrap up Mosiah 7.
Well, if I can point to something at the end of Mosiah 7, I'm struck by the last four verses, really. Behold, verse starting with 29, the Lord hath said, I will not succor my people in the day of their transgression, but I will hedge up their ways. You know, verse 30, again, he saith, my people shall sow filthiness, they shall reap the chaff thereof. And he's saying, you know, we brought this on ourselves. Then verse 31, especially, again, he saith, if my people shall sow filthiness, they shall reap the east wind, which bringeth immediate destruction. Now, I've lived in Israel and the Middle East, I don't know, what is it, 5 years, and visited every year for year after year after year after year. So this immediately strikes me as a very Middle Eastern kind of thing to say. If you live in Israel, the west wind comes off the Mediterranean. It brings moisture. You know, when Elijah is up there with the priests of Baal, you know, he sees the cloud a little bigger than a man's hand. It's coming off the Mediterranean Sea. It's bringing rain to end the drought. But the wind that comes off from the east, it's coming over the Jordanian-Syrian desert. It is dry as can be. I mean, it makes Nevada look like a tropical rainforest, right? And so it's bringing blistering hot winds and often sand with it that destroys crops, evaporates the water, that sort of thing. And so this, I think, is something they brought with them as an image from the Middle East, from their home in Israel, in the land of Palestine, because the east wind is not a good thing. It's usually hot and dry, and that's not what you want for your crops. Interestingly, there's an article by Kerry Hull, who's a Mayanist down at BYU, where he says, you know, the funny thing is, the east wind idea also is common among the Maya, at least. The east wind was associated with evil and destruction. So I think there was a Middle Eastern background to this term and an American background. But it's striking. The east wind is a bad thing.
Fascinating. Great insight. Thank you for that. Chapter 8 has Ammon learning about this discovery of these 24 plates and how he acquires these and describes them. Let's jump into Chapter 8 if you'd like to do that.
Well, this is really important because you know what these 24 plates are going to turn out to be. They're going to be the story of the Jaredites. And they're in a language that nobody there can understand, but there is someone, Ammon explains, who does have the gift, and that's King Mosiah, who has the gift of being a seer. But it strikes me that, again, there's a group sent out from the land of first inheritance to try to find Zarahemla, their sort of quasi-ancestral home, and they can't find it. They think they've found it, but what they actually find is the place where the Jaredites had had their last battle, so somewhere near Cumorah. And they discover the wreckage of this last lost civilization and ruins of buildings and bones of dead people. And their natural conclusion is, oh, good grief, we found Zarahemla, and they're all dead. We're on our own, you know, which turns out to be wrong. But again, it suggests that navigating this territory is hard. The distances aren't great, but it's hard to find your way around in. Everybody gets lost. But this discovery of these plates is really important. It's a discovery of what will become the basis of a whole chapter of Scripture. So it's kind of fun to see it happening here. They have no idea yet what's in it.
It's a great story. One of the other, maybe I should or maybe I shouldn't bring up all these comments about critics, but I like to bring them up and then toss them down or, you know, smash them back down because people still to this day, you know, hear some of these criticisms and often they don't know how to answer them. So I think it's often important to do that. One of the discussions/debates, although it was a friendly one that I had with a former Mormon, ex-Mormon who now lives in Southern California, who has a website that I won't mention, but that's okay. And one of his comments about why he refused to believe in the church and the Book of Mormon anymore was because here in Mosiah, in chapter 11, talks about swords during the Jaredite era. And he said, we don't have any evidence of smelting back in 2000 BC or 2500 BC. And I said, well, I won't mention his name, but I don't have permission today, but I said they didn't necessarily have to be smelted, but if they were, it's pretty difficult for something to have lasted in that kind of an environment for 2,500 years. And we know that the metals were available to do that. I mean, this is the current theory is that iron comes from outer space. This is not like an actually a naturally occurring element, and that shows up in meteorites. And one of the largest meteorite landings was in the Gulf of, yeah, of Mexico, right off there, and that accounts for all of the mining in Central and the upper portion of South America that involves iron ore and things. And I mentioned that to him, and he didn't have as much to say after that, other than we don't have evidence of mining. And I said, well, that's not something you would expect, but the raw materials are certainly there.
Yeah. Well, and there are other ways of looking at swords. We shouldn't necessarily imagine that they would look like the swords that we see in Hollywood movies. My late lamented friend Bill Hamblin was an expert on medieval and ancient Middle Eastern weapons. And one of the things that he pointed out was that the conquistadores, when they encountered the Aztecs, described the Aztec weapons as swords. You know, the Spaniards were professional swordsmen. That's what they did for a living. They didn't just see them in movies. They right. fought with them. They knew what a sword was. And they saw the studded obsidian maquitl of the right. Aztecs as a sword. And you say, well, oh, no, it's really a club. Well, it could sever a horse's head from its body
yes.
with one blow.
Yeah,
that's not a club. That's a sword. The obsidian blades were very sharp. It behaved like a sword. And since the professional conquistador swordsmen called them swords in their accounts, I see no reason why I shouldn't call them a sword. Now, what was it that the Jaredites and Nephites had? I don't know exactly. But there are a lot of candidates for this sort of thing.
There are. Verse 11 does mention rust, so that implies metal, but there were certainly many other kinds of swords, and the ones that were stained red with blood that would be in a different location certainly implies the maquitl with
yeah.
with wooden handles.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's jump back into the story. You mentioned the whole idea of a prophet, and we've got somebody who can actually read these plates. Interpreters are mentioned. Gee, the Interpreter Radio Show, the Interpreter Foundation.
Wonder where we got that idea.
Yeah, I wonder where that came from. Interpreter to explain or to elucidate or to make clear or understandable, to translate. That would be a great name for a foundation.
If we ever start one, maybe we'll call it that.
That's right. So.
Yeah, so, you know, the king is obviously puzzled. He's got to be asking himself now, gosh, we thought maybe that was Zarahemla, but it turns out you've just arrived from Zarahemla and you say they're fine. So that obviously wasn't Zarahemla, and we found these plates with this weird writing on them. So can you help me figure out what it says? I mean, this is working on his mind now. They are delighted to find out that Zarahemla still exists and there's still people, you know, living in it. But then that creates a new problem. Then who did we find? And what are these records?
So let's talk about what a prophet is. These are great descriptions, which are relevant for us today, verses 15, 16, yeah. and 17.
Yeah, you know, the king's listening to Ammon explain it. He's hearing about a seer, a man who has this great gift that he can translate all records via these interpreters. And the king said, a seer is greater than a prophet. And I think maybe it's dawning on him. And Ammon said that a seer is a revelator and a prophet also. That is, the gift of seership includes those other things. And a gift which is greater can no man have, except he should possess the power of God, which no man can. So it's a really exalted position. And so it strikes me that a prophet is a person who simply conveys a message from God. a seer is a person who has the capacity to see distant things in the past and in the future. A prophet may be a person who just comes and says, God wants you to repent. But a seer can see things. That's what it means. And when we sustain our leaders today as prophets, seers, and revelators, it doesn't mean that at every moment they're doing that, but it means they have the authority to do that. If God calls upon them to do it, they have the keys and the power to do it.
One of the descriptions in Whitmer's reminiscences of the time when Joseph Smith acquired the plates and the Urim and Thummim that always struck me as real and fits in very well with this is where he says, well, Joseph thought the plates were okay, but he really liked the Urim and Thummim because he said they were marvelous. I could see anything.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
you see that and you go, wow, that just fits right in with this description.
Being a seer.
That's right.
You know? And there are stories about Joseph seeing things at a distance, you know, when he shouldn't have been able to, you know, when David Whitmer shows up, you know, they're not surprised to see him. Joseph says, well, yeah, I saw you. You stayed at such and such an inn and so on. And it turns out to be true. Joseph could see things at a distance. Again, not always. I'm sure he was surprised by things, but on occasion he could.
He could when it was needed. We have about 10 minutes. Should we wrap up chapter 8 and then in a nutshell, 9 and 10?
Yeah, you know, there's so much to say here.
There is.
You know, when they first started talking about having a course on the Book of Mormon at BYU years ago before I came as a student, there were faculty members who said, well, how in the world would you fill a whole semester with the Book of Mormon? Now we teach it for a year when it's taught at BYU. And I'm always thinking, oh, gosh, I wish I had five times as much time for this. There's so much in this book. So we're just scratching the surface. But, yeah, chapter 9, we begin the record of Zenith, who is the person who actually led that colony or that group to reconnoiter the land. And he tells the story of how they got into trouble. And I noticed that he's described as overzealous to inherit the land, both by himself and by the king previously who was telling the story. It's an interesting word. He's overzealous. I think he was uncareful. He allowed himself to be trapped. So
maybe Nibley read that when he said zeal without knowledge.
That's right. And that this was an illustration of that. That he should have had his eyes open and he didn't. He got his people into a serious jam. But, you know, it's interesting because he has good qualities and bad qualities. They check out the Lamanites and he decides, you know, they really shouldn't be destroyed. They have good qualities. They're not evil. I've been raised to believe they were evil, but they're not. I don't want to kill them all. And so there's a battle within the army fragments, and their mission is a disaster. But then he goes back.
I really enjoyed that description and have in the past because typically the Lamanites are kind of a foil for the goodness of the Nephites and the wickedness of the Lamanites.
Yeah.
But here's a moment of truth about the people not being wholly evil.
Yeah.
They have good qualities. I love that description,
yeah.
Aaron.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more real.
Yeah, I think it is. I think the Book of Mormon can be viewed too simply as a black and white conflict. But, you know, half the Book of Mormon, really, the Lamanites are better than the Nephites. Or at least the prophets will say they're not to be condemned because they don't have the knowledge you guys have.
Right.
You know, you do wrong and you know you're doing wrong. They do wrong because they were taught this way by their fathers.
And there are descriptions of that right here where it talks about, and I'd have to find it here, jumping ahead to chapter 10, verse 17,
yeah,
where it talks about how they were taught. They taught their children that they should hate the Nephites,
yeah,
and that they should murder them and that they should rob and plunder them and do all that they could to destroy them. Therefore, they have an eternal hatred towards the children of Nephi. That's what you're talking about. And it is so profound what the influence on children can mean for their subsequent life.
Yeah, you know, stories of the past really can influence our perception of the present. if we have an incorrect attitude or incorrect idea of what happened, what was done to us. You know, so he gives some details of the story the Lamanites are told in verses 12 and 13. You know, they were a wild and ferocious, bloodthirsty people, believing in the tradition of their fathers, which is this, believing they were driven out of the land of Jerusalem because of the iniquities of their fathers. I mean, that's a completely turning the story of Lehi on its head, right? And that they were wronged in the wilderness by their brethren. And they were also wronged while crossing the sea. At every point where Laman and Lemuel were the wrongers, turns out they're the innocent victims. Again,
the victim mentality.
Yeah,
that's right.
That they were wronged while in the land of their first inheritance after they had crossed the sea. I mean, it's a litany. It's an endless list of we were victims here and victims there. And so it's right that we hate the Nephites. We hate them. And, you know, I have to say, as a person who spent a lot of time in the Middle East and studying the Middle East, this is kind of the thing that goes on there. People are taught from the time they're little kids, that group wronged us. Therefore, we hate them. Therefore, anything we do to them is okay. And it's poisonous.
Yeah. Hence, they are monkeys and pigs.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. Very, very, very tragic. And,
yeah.
You know, to thankfully, a lesser extent, some of that can be traced in Christianity as well. It's the Jews did this, or the Jews did, and, you know, we see that, and it's...
Yeah,
it's a bit tragic.
Well, you know, I was just watching something about the Black Plague the other day, and who were the first victims of the Black Plague in a way? The Jews. Because, you know, something obviously has happened that's really, really evil. Well, who did it? Well, obviously it's the Jews, so let's go kill them.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't understand the germ theory of disease, so it must have been the Jews.
Yeah. It's sad how people find a scapegoat, as it were, for all the evil in the world and don't want to take responsibility themselves.
Yeah, so I hate to say it, but this description of the hatred of the Lamanites for the Nephites strikes me as really believable. If you listen to the propaganda that comes out of Iran, for example, against Israel or against the United States, the other day I was telling somebody that I remember, I wish I'd marked it, when I saw it, but years and years and years ago, probably 20 years ago, there was an outbreak of anthrax in the southwestern part of Iran. Anthrax happens. I mean, it's a disease that occurs among cattle and kills a lot of cattle. So the Iranian government didn't handle it very well, as they're not handling the COVID-19 coronavirus problem right now. So what they announced was that it was the fault of the Israelis and the Americans. They claimed that Israeli Mossad agents and CIA operatives were parachuting into southwestern Iran and injecting the cattle with anthrax.
Yeah.
That's just absurd. It's absurd. Yeah. It's an infectious disease.
Well, we see the Chinese propaganda that the American soldiers are responsible for coronavirus. It's the same kind of thing today.
It's a favorite technique of dictators or unjust rulers, maybe including the Lamanites, that whatever problems you have, you blame on them, those guys, the other. Not me. It's not my incompetence or my injustice. It's them.
We have about 4 minutes left here. Let's talk briefly and wrap it up about the plates and their significance. We're just jumping into them. Chapters 9 and 10 don't complete the story of these 24 plates.
Right.
But there's significance here, and it goes through the time where King Laman dies.
Yeah. Well, as I say, those plates are really, really important. They don't know that yet. They have no idea what they are. So if they know they can't read them, they're apparently in a script that they've never seen before. It's not related to theirs, which is believable. The Jaredites have a very non-Israelite origin. I mean, one of the things they have with them is pigs, which tells you they're not Law of Moses abiding Israelites. So they're very, very foreign. Their script, who knows what it is, cuneiform or something else. I mean, they seem to have come from Mesopotamia. That's not Israelite territory. So there's nobody here who can read it in any natural way. So they're looking for some help, and the only way to do that is supernaturally.
Descriptions about King Laman and maybe some parting shots about the message that we're supposed to get from these chapters?
Well, I think one of the messages is one we've already alluded to, which is about deliverance, that righteousness will preserve you. If you're in serious problems, righteousness gives you the right to claim divine support. If you're wicked, you have no such claim. And so they fell into this trap because they were greedy. And, they say they were not particularly faithful. So it got them into serious trouble. But deliverance is maybe the whole theme of the book of Mosiah, which is interesting because one of the proposed etymologies for the name Mosiah is Moshiach, not Meshiach, which is Messiah, but Moshiach, which there's a famous article, famous among some Latter-day Saint scholars, by John Sawyer in Vetus Testamentum back in 65, I think, where he asks, what is a Moshiach? And he says he's a non-violent savior who intervenes and saves an oppressed people, through divine means and so on and so forth. And the whole book, Moshiach, Mosiah, I think that's what's going on here. It's about deliverance from bondage.
Wonderful story, wonderful theme. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion for Come Follow Me of Mosiah chapters 7 through 10. And we hope you'll take a moment to go to the website for the Interpreter Foundation, MormonInterpreter.com. And especially during the time of the coronavirus, we hope that you will gain some comfort and solace from turning towards God and from reading God's scriptures and from the knowledge that God is in charge and that He has not forgotten us or anyone else, and that as we draw nigh unto Him, He will draw nigh unto us, especially on this day of fasting and prayer suggested by President Nelson.
Thank you. Yeah, and the first hour was about even death is not the end. We'll be delivered from that too. So there is hope. In fact, forget despair. Hope is the important thing.
Hope is the important thing. Join us again next week right here on KTalk Media, which is 1640 AM, or on the Internet, KTalk Media. I'm Martin Tanner in studio with Professor Daniel Peterson. Join us then. Thanks for being with us tonight.